Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Anna Mateo and Pete Musto. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, the third Monday of February is known as President's Day in the United States. For nearly 100 years, America honored its first president, George Washington, on February 22nd. That was his birthday. But the date was not a national holiday until 1968. That year, the U.S. Congress passed a measure known as the Uniform Monday Holiday Act. The measure meant that some public holidays would always fall on a Monday. Today, the country honors its first president on the third Monday in February, and not on Washington's real birthday. And the holiday is now commonly called President's Day. Many say it also honors Abraham Lincoln's birthday. The nation's 16th president was born on February 12th. The federal government, however, still recognizes the holiday as Washington's birthday. The Uniform Monday Holiday Act gives workers a 3-day weekend. It also gives shops and marketers a chance to have special President's Day sales.
Last year, Donald J. Trump made history when he took the oath of office as the 45th President of the United States. At 70 years old, he became the oldest elected president. Before Trump, Ronald Reagan was the oldest person to take office. He was 69 years old when he became president in 1981. As the first billionaire president, Trump also replaced John F. Kennedy, the 35th president, as the richest man in office. Kennedy still holds the record for the youngest person to be elected president. He was 43 when he took office. Kennedy is also the youngest president to die in office. He was assassinated in 1963 in Dallas, Texas. He was 46 years old. Another presidential assassination actually put the youngest person in the office of the president. In 1901, Theodore Roosevelt, then the vice president, became president at the age of 42. He took office after William McKinley, the 25th president, was shot and killed in Buffalo, New York. The first president to die in office, though, was William Henry Harrison. The country's 9th president only served 32 days, the shortest time of any president. Another Roosevelt held the record for the longest time in office. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the 32nd president, held office for 4,422 days. After his death, the 22nd Amendment was passed. It limits a person to 2 4-year terms as president.
Thank you. A ban on electric bicycles in New York City is hurting delivery workers who depend on them to earn a living. Many of the workers are immigrants. Electric bicycles, or e-bikes, have foot-powered pedals like other bicycles. But they also have electric-powered motors to assist riders in moving the bike forward. Most e-bikes reach speeds of about 32 kilometers an hour, but some can go much faster. Iman Liu often uses an e-bike to deliver up to 40 Chinese food orders all across Manhattan each day. He is 60 years old. He says an e-bike makes his job much easier.
My legs are no good. I'm not capable of riding a regular bike. Both of my feet hurt. I have arthritis on both sides.
Although it is legal to own e-bikes in New York City, it is not legal to operate them. Officials there cite the dangerous use of e-bikes on streets and sidewalks as reason for the ban. Last year, the city announced severe measures meant to hold e-bike riders and restaurants that employ the riders responsible. E-bike operators can now be fined $500 for violating the ban. Police can also seize the bikes. Iman Liu says he fears he might physically collapse if he tried to complete his daily work using a normal bicycle. He also estimates he could only deliver about half the number of orders. Many of New York's delivery workers are Chinese immigrants in their 50s and 60s. Their job requires them to work quickly and for long hours in order to earn enough money to live on. Delivery worker Duqing Lian said it is important to perform quality work because their job also depends on tips.
Sometimes we go to places that are very far. If we're too slow, the customers will be unhappy.
He added that when delivery workers are too slow, some people refuse to pay for the food. This makes the workers' supervisors angry. Liqiang Liu is an e-bike delivery worker and spokesperson for the New York Delivery Workers Union. He says being caught violating the ban and having the bike seized would cause costly delays for workers. Do Li is with the Biking Public Project, which provides assistance to bicycle-related workers in New York City. He says the city's ban on e-bikes is unfairly targeting low-paid workers who largely come from the city's Latino and Asian communities. He does not accept the argument that e-bikes present a danger to citizens. I'm Brian Lynn.
Two scientists work together to test a geo-radar that was built to make a map of the planet Mars. They pull the flat box across rocky, sandy ground. They are wearing space suits, just like astronauts do in space. The bright white on their protective equipment stands out against the color of the sand and dirt. When the geo-radar stops working, the two walk back to their vehicles and use a radio to contact scientists at a nearby base camp for guidance. They are unable to speak directly with their command station, which is far away in the European Alps. Communications from there are delayed 10 minutes. The scientists are not on the planet Mars. They are in a desert in southern Oman, near the borders of Yemen and Saudi Arabia. The desert looks so much like Mars that scientists chose it to field test technology for a manned spaceflight to the Red Planet. The United States government and a few American companies have established programs to send astronauts to Mars. Former U.S. President Barack Obama and SpaceX founder Elon Musk have both declared that astronauts would walk on the planet in just a few decades.
China is joining the U.S. and Russia in space with its own Mars program. And aerospace companies like Blue Origin have published plans for future bases, ships, and spacesuits. Last week's successful launch of SpaceX's Falcon Heavy rocket puts us in a completely different realm of what we can put into deep space, says Kartik Kumar. He is an analog astronaut. Analog astronauts carry out tests in preparation for a Mars spaceflight. The next step after the rocket test, Kumar says, is to deal with non-engineering problems, such as how to react to a medical emergency in space. These are things I think can't be underestimated, Kumar noted.
Most of the work to prepare for the interplanetary trips is being done on Earth. Our planet's deserts provide some of the best environments to field test equipment and people for the trip to Mars. From space, the Dhofar Desert is a flat, brown area. Few animals or plants can survive in this part of the Arabian Peninsula. Temperatures can top 51 degrees Celsius. On the eastern edge of a seemingly endless sand dune is the Oman Mars Base. The base is a huge, self-contained area in which people live and work. It is surrounded by shipping containers, which serve as laboratories and living space for the crew. The desert's surface looks so much like Mars that it can be hard to tell the difference, Kumar said. Its salt domes and riverbeds, he said, look like a lot of what we see on Mars.
Oman's government offered to host the Austrian Space Forum's next Mars simulation. The offer came at a meeting of the United Nations Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space. Gernot Groomer, commander of the Oman Mars simulation, said his group quickly accepted. Scientists from across the world sent ideas for experiments. The project quickly grew to 16 scientific experiments, including testing a new spacesuit called IUDA. The spacesuit weighs about 50 kilograms. It is called a personal spaceship because one can breathe, eat, and do complex science inside of it. The suit's visor can show maps, communications, and sensor information.
The Soviet Union's 1957 launch of Sputnik led to a space race with the goal of putting people on the moon. But before the American space agency NASA got there, astronauts like Neil Armstrong trained while suspended on pulleys, or lifts, to simulate 1/6 of Earth's gravity. Scientists used hostile environments in places like Arizona and Siberia to test space capsules, landers, and suits, simulating dangers found beyond Earth.
Among many Mars scientists, a favorite book is Packing for Mars by Mary Roach. The book notes that test space stations have been built underwater off the coast of Florida, in dark and cold deserts in Antarctica, and in volcanic craters in Hawaii. NASA scientists used the Mojave Desert in the western U.S. to test vehicles meant for Mars. The scientists also found out a lot about how humans can adapt to different environments. Humans' adaptability in an unstructured environment is still far, far better than any robot we can send to space, said Scott Hubbard, who once led the U.S. Space Agency's Mars program. Hubbard added that people, not just robots, are important to exploring Mars. I'm Anna Mateo.
And I'm Pete Musto.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In the summer of 1858, two candidates campaigned across the state of Illinois for a seat in the United States Senate. That seat belonged to Stephen Douglas from the Democratic Party. He was seeking re-election. His opponent was a lawyer from the newly established Republican Party. His name was Abraham Lincoln. Frank Oliver and Larry West tell us about this campaign of statewide but also national importance.
Abraham Lincoln proposed that he and Stephen Douglas hold several debates. The rules for each debate would be the same. One man would speak for an hour. His opponent would speak for an hour and a half. Then the first man would speak for half an hour to close the debate. Douglas agreed. There were seven debates in all. They were held in towns throughout Illinois. In some places, there was great interest in what the two candidates had to say. Thousands of people attended. Douglas was a short, heavy man. One reporter said he looked like a fierce bulldog. Douglas' friends and supporters called him the Little Giant. Lincoln was just the opposite. He was very tall and thin, with long arms and legs. His clothes did not fit well, and he had a plain face, one which many thought was ugly. He looked more like a simple farmer than a candidate for the United States Senate.
The Lincoln-Douglas debates covered party politics and the future of the nation. But everything the two men discussed was tied to one issue, slavery. Douglas spoke first at the first debate. He questioned a statement made in one of Lincoln's campaign speeches. Lincoln had said that the United States could not continue to permit slavery in some areas while banning it in others. He said the Union could not stand so divided. It must either permit slavery everywhere or nowhere. Douglas did not agree. He noted that the country had been half slave and half free for 70 years. Why then, he asked, should it not continue to exist that way? The United States was a big country. What was best for one part might not be best for another.
Then Douglas questioned Lincoln's statement on the Supreme Court's Dred Scott decision. Lincoln had said he opposed the decision because it did not permit Negroes to enjoy the rights of citizenship. Douglas said he believed the decision was correct. He said it was clear that the government had been made by white men for white men. He said he opposed Negro citizenship. "I do not accept the Negro as my equal," Douglas said, "and I deny that he is my brother. However," he said, "this does not mean I believe that Negroes should be slaves. Negroes should enjoy every possible right that does not threaten the safety of the society in which they live. Every state and territory must decide for itself what these rights will be. Illinois decided that Negroes will not be citizens, but that it will protect their life, property, and civil rights. It keeps from Negroes only political rights and refuses to make Negroes equal to white men." "That policy satisfies me," Douglas said, "and it satisfies the Democratic Party."
Then Lincoln spoke. First, he denied that the Republican Party was an abolitionist party. "I have no purpose," he said, "either directly or indirectly, to interfere with slavery where it exists. I believe I have no legal right to do so, nor do I wish to do so. I do not," Lincoln said, "wish to propose political and social equality between the white and black races." "But," he went on, "there is no reason in the world why Negroes should not have all the natural rights listed in the Declaration of Independence, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." "I agree with Judge Douglas," Lincoln said, "that the Negro is not my equal in many ways, certainly not in color, perhaps not mentally or morally. But in the right to eat the bread that his own hand earns, he is my equal and the equal of Judge Douglas and the equal of every living man."
Lincoln then defended his statement that the United States could not continue half slave and half free. He said he did not mean that customs or institutions must be the same in every state. He said it was healthy and necessary for differences to exist in a country so large. He said different customs and institutions helped unite the country, not divide it. But Lincoln questioned if slavery was such an institution. He said slavery had not tied the states of the Union together, but had always been an issue that divided them. How had the country existed half slave and half free for so many years? Lincoln asked. Because, he said, the men who created the government believed that slavery was only temporary. Once people understood that slavery was not permanent, the crisis would pass. Slavery could be left alone in the South until it slowly died. That way, Lincoln said, would be best for both the white and black races.
Stephen Douglas and Abraham Lincoln were campaigning for a Senate seat from the state of Illinois. But their debates had national importance, too. Douglas expected to be the Democratic candidate for president in 1860. His statements could win or lose him support for that contest. Whenever possible, he tried to show that he was a man of the people, like Lincoln. He tried to show that his Democratic Party was a national party, while the Republican Party was a party only of the North. And he tried to show that Lincoln's policies would lead to civil war.
Lincoln, for his part, may have looked like a simple farmer, but he was a very smart lawyer and politician. He asked questions which he knew would cause trouble for Douglas. He wanted to create a split between Douglas and his supporters in the South. Lincoln also wanted to keep alive the debate over slavery. That, he said, is the real issue. That is the issue that will continue in this country when these poor tongues of Judge Douglas and myself are silent. It is the eternal struggle between right and wrong.
In Illinois in 1858, the state legislature chose the men who would represent the state in the National Senate. So Stephen Douglas and Abraham Lincoln had to depend on legislative support to get to Washington. On Election Day, the legislative candidates supporting Lincoln won 4,000 more popular votes than the candidates supporting Douglas. But because of the way election areas had been organized, the Douglas Democrats won a majority of seats. The newly elected legislature chose him to be senator.
Lincoln was sad that he had not won, but he said he was glad to have tried. The campaign, he said, gave me a hearing on the great question of the age, which I could have had in no other way. And though I now sink out of view and shall be forgotten, I believe I have made some marks which will tell for the cause of civil liberty long after I have gone. Many people, however, did not think Abraham Lincoln would be forgotten. His campaign speeches had been published everywhere in the East. His name was becoming widely known. People began to speak of him as a presidential candidate. To win the presidential election of 1860, the Republican Party had decided it needed a man of the people. He must be a good politician and leader. He must be opposed to slavery, but not too extreme. Many people thought Lincoln could be that man.
After the election in Illinois, Lincoln made several speaking trips in the western states. In none of his speeches did he say he might be a candidate for president in 1860. If anyone said anything about Lincoln for president, he would answer that he did not have the ability. Or he would say there were better men in the party than himself. Lincoln said, "Only events can make a president." He would wait for those events.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.